Thanks for coming on this Easter Sunday, and as usual, I don't have a topical lecture. This is an ongoing part of a series which sort of emphasizes sports analogies. The first one was called Game Plan. The second one was called Calling an Audible. And this one is called The Playbook. If you're a part of a football team, a professional football team, you can turn that down just a little bit, Hanuman. If you're part of a professional football team, you have what's called a playbook. And it's all the plays in your arsenal, all the plays in your repertoire. Doesn't mean you're going to use all those plays in a particular game, but you've got a whole gamut of plays, and you do drills, and you go through them, and you become familiar with them. And that's basically what's going to get you through the season. If you meet a certain opponent, and you decide during that particular contest to change the playbook, if you want to play by their playbook or play their game, it's going to be a fiasco. You've got to go by the things that you've practiced, that you've studied, and you've drilled for. And your playbook is going to be based on your strengths. As a team, you might be strong in running. You might be strong in the short passing game. You might be strong in the long passing game. You might not be strong in any of those. You might be strong in defense. And defense also has a playbook as well. So you've got to stick to your playbook. That's your only chance of winning and having a successful season. If halfway through the season or halfway through a game you decide to go by someone else's playbook or go by some other team's playbook, it's going to turn out to be totally disastrous. And that's what our talk is about today. It's about sticking to our playbook. We started this series by saying there is a God and He has a great plan for your life. And sometimes it's hard to discern what that plan is. In the first talk, we talked about how God is not meant to be a component of your life, but He's meant to be your life. He's not to be on the periphery of your life, but He's meant to take center place in your life. And so at the end of the first talk, our question changed from what should I do with my life to what should I do with your life, which is within me. And then the second talk, which was called Calling an Audible, we talked about the three aspects of God's will. Providential will, things that are going to happen anyway. The moral will for us, what God's moral standard that He would like us to adhere to and reap the long-term benefits of that. And understanding His providential will and His moral will, it becomes easier to understand what His personal will for our lives is. Today's talk is about using the plays in your own arsenal, in your own playbook. Going with your own strengths and not running somebody else's race. If there is a God and He has a great plan for our lives, then we need to be true to that plan and true to what He made us to be. These are all based on the teachings of His divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Imagine if you were signed up for a 10K, you and your wife was going to walk it and you were going to run it. But the night before the race, some or other, you'd gone and you pre-registered and you got the bibs, but you'd switched the bibs. So when you got up in the morning, you donned your running gear, she put on your bib and you put on her bib. You ran the race and the race results came out the next day on the internet. And it turns out that she ran your race in 58 minutes, right? She walked your race in 58 minutes, and you ran her race in an hour and 40 minutes. And that wouldn't be satisfying. So you need to run your own race, not your brother's race, not your father's race, not your employer's race. You need to run your own race. And a lot of our lives are spent doing what other people would have us to do, being convinced by what other people argue in favor of. And we're running other people's race, feeling at the same time that there's a tremendous potential that's unleashed if we were to find out and run the race that's unique to us. I remember one time I was San Francisco Temple president. This is sometime 1976. And I did a lot of lectures, and I have my own style of public speaking. So one time, myself and another well-known lecturer named Dharma Dyaksha, who was also very famous, he was also very, very proficient, we were going to the University of San Francisco together, and it so happened we had to give simultaneous talks. He was in one classroom and I was in another classroom. And the whole ride over, he was telling me about his style of lecturing, which involved asking questions and getting the answers. And he was telling me about it, and I was getting the details, and I was getting the details, and I was getting the details. And it wasn't like I decided to try his style, but it was just I got brainwashed on the way over. It was so much in my mind, and so much of the details, and I became so much enamored with it, that I departed from a normal style of lecturing, and I tried to do his style. And it was a total fiasco. It was a total disaster. It's the only time in giving maybe 5,000 lectures in public forums that I've walked away red-faced and shameful because I knew it had not gone over well. And it's not because I'm not a good talker, but it's because I wasn't running my race. That some or other, I decided that I wasn't going to run my race, that some or other by running his race, I would get a better result. And that never, ever happens. You never, ever get a better result running someone else's race. In fact, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, he goes so far as to say that running your own race, it's better, it's a higher result if you meet with destruction running your own race rather than try to run someone else's race. You have to run your own race. We shouldn't be beat up or beat down by someone else, you know. We have to find our race to run. You might have lived in the shadow of an older brother who was a brilliant scholar or a brilliant athlete, and your parents seemed to be favoring him and talking more about him, and you just put your head down and down and down and down and down, and you felt you should be like him, you should be a scholar like him, you should be an athlete like him. And you wanted to do that. You wanted to be like him in order to get the praise from your parents, but it never seemed to happen. It never seemed to happen. So you can't live in someone else's shadow, and you can't run someone else's race, because God created you as one of a kind. In all of the creation, there isn't another soul like you. You can go throughout all the entire material and spiritual universes and you'll not find a carbon copy of yourself. That God is such a creator that he made every living being unique and separate from one another. And that means that each one of you has your own separate individual race to run. That kind of sounds like a Hallmark card, but we're going to give you a clue today, a very strong clue, a huge clue in fact, about how you can tell what race it is that you're meant to run. And it has to do with the way that God created you. It has to do with God's thumbprint on you. When you discover what God's thumbprint on you is, then you'll also discover what God's race for you is and what his plans for you are. We'll skip a couple slides here to a story that I'm sure you're all familiar with. It's a story of the talents in the Bible, and I won't get into any detail, but basically a man gave three of his sons different amounts of money. And at the end of it, each one had to account to his father for what he'd done with the money. And when we come before God at the end of this life, and we have to account before God with what we did with the talents that he gave us, you do not want to say the following things. Well, I never got around to it. I never got around to using the talents that you give me. I never really found the time, or I spend my time trying to imitate someone else, or I was always comparing myself with other people and I really forgot the mission that you had for me. I just put my head down and I gave up. So we don't want to say that. And when you think about it, you know, the time we actually spend, the time we actually sit down and try and figure out what God's thumbprint on us is and what his plan for us is probably not nearly the same amount of time we spend picking our fantasy football team or nearly the amount of time that we spend on Facebook, you see. And yet, if there's one question we're going to be asked at the end of this life, it is going to be, what did you do with your talents? And God's not going to say, you know, maybe you have an older brother who was a famous doctor, or a younger brother who's a chef. God's not going to ask you about the doctoring. He's not going to hold you accountable for the things that your brother was uniquely gifted to do. He's not going to ask you, he's not going to sit down with you and compare recipes. He might do that with your younger brother, but he's not going to do that with you. He's going to ask you about your unique talents and your unique abilities. So if God doesn't want you to be accountable to your brother and doesn't want to be accountable to your father and all like that, so then why should you be accountable to anyone other than him? Why should you be accountable to anyone but him? So how to find those thumbprints on you? One problem is the thumbprint of God on us is often indicated by the things that our friends tell us. Or what to speak of friends, have you ever had a stranger, someone you've never met before, come up and tell you, how did you do that? That was absolutely amazing. How did you do that? Jerry's not here today, But Jerry is amazing with computers. I mean, he's amazing and he loves it. Something that I would just get so frustrated at and be gnashing my teeth and maybe even considering a swear word, you know. Jerry has a smile on his face and he just throws himself right in there and he's just like in heaven. And he figures it out. And I don't know how he does that. Crystal walks into the temple like 5 months ago. She starts chanting Sanskrit better than any of us who've been trying it for 40 years. Just comes right out bubbling off of her lips. I don't know how she did that. I don't know how she got that talent. You know, Sean's been here a few days. Sean is very nourishing. He's very replenishing. He's very, very empathetic. He's a very, very good people person. And I look at Sean, I say, wow, what a gift. That's just amazing. That's just amazing. Will's been here a week ago, and you feel a deep integrity. You feel that Will has a very, very deep, rock-hard foundation of integrity to him. And these are all gifts. They're also clues which lead us to the race that God has set out for us. And what we should do is not be falsely modest, not deny the talents or diminish them, but lean into them. Listen to what others say about us, affirm them, and confirm them. You know, people say sometimes, true, you're a good speaker, you know. I don't deny that. At the same time, I don't take credit. I'm not a good speaker because of me. I'm a good speaker because it's a gift from God. And I have an obligation, I have a duty to use that gift from God as much as I can. When God asks me, what did you do with your gift? I'll say, you know, I gave 5,000 lectures in high schools and colleges. I gave 5,000 lectures plus. I gave so many Sunday feasts. A few weeks ago, an old guy from Senior Citizen Center in Kearns calls me up and he says, we'd like you to come out on the 11th of April and speak to our senior citizens. We'll have a special room set aside for you. And I said, I asked some questions, I got the directions, and as I was about to hang up the phone, I said, oh, by the way, how many will be there? And he says, oh, maybe we could get 10. And I'm thinking, a 100-mile round trip for maybe 10 senior citizens, most of whom might even be in stages of Alzheimer's, I don't know. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I've already committed to it. It's a gift. I should share the gift. I should do the gift. So, and he calls a couple more times and changes it. So finally, it's the 18th of April, which actually works out okay because I'm supposed to pick up Sean at the airport a little bit later on. So I'm thinking, God's helping me out here. So I get there at 1 o'clock. I say, I'm here. And I get the blank look from the receptionist. And I say, a guy, Mike Muck something or other, called me 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, supposed to give a, oh, you just missed him. You just missed him. Let me call him up and get him together. You know, maybe call him. See, he might be at the library or something. And I said, I didn't come here to meet with Mike. I came here because Mike said that he would have a classroom and that he would have a group of up to 10 people to hear about Krishna consciousness, you know. So anyway, Mike never showed up. Mike never called to apologize. But at least when God says, what did you do with your gifts? I can tell him that I was always willing to go anywhere at any time and speak to anyone. And that'll be a good case in point. A good case in point. So I will be able to hold my head up when God asks me, what did you do with your gift of public speaking, you see? And in a sense, you know, the whole project here, I mean, it's a project that engages many people on many different levels. But my motivation is to use the gift. My motivation is to use the gift and to go into Salt Lake City. We want to have a Saturday night program and a Sunday night program. It'll involve musicians, it'll involve pujaris, it'll involve cooks, it'll involve festival organizers, it'll involve all kinds of things. But it'll also involve public speaking, which is one of the reasons that I do what I do and what we've and why we've evolved to what we've evolved for. So if someone comes up and says, you know, you're amazing about that, don't deny it. Admit it. Admit it. It's a gift. Don't, you know, people don't want to appear falsely prideful. I'm humble. And so they say, well, you know, I'm not really interested in hearing. Oh, no, it's not me. And, you know, nothing to do with me. And they deny the gifts that God's given them. I remember when I was young, there were always people dropping by our house. And that's another thing that I had when I was growing up, is hospitality. My parents were always ready to receive anyone who dropped in. with a kind word, a place to sit, some refreshments, and so on and so forth. So especially on the weekends, people were coming and going. I remember we lived in this house in Pennsylvania that was built during the Revolutionary War, an ancient and a historical house with stones this big, and it had a Dutch door. So the top half of the door would swing open on a nice summer day. And I remember so many times, you know, there would be guests and visitors, and I would, you know, you would see the top half above the top of the Dutch door, and they were coming to visit. So hospitality is a very important thing. But if someone says, "You're such a good host," no, I'm not a good host. I just make good brownies. That's not only is it false humility, but it actually borders on lying. It actually borders on lying. So rather than, you know, leaning away from our talents or abilities, lean into them. Acknowledge that you're gifted and be diligent is the word. Be diligent in giving yourself into this endeavor. It's a flame. God gives you a little flame and we shouldn't let it go out. We need to nourish it. We need to fan it. We need to feed it so that the flame gets bigger and bigger, because that's God in us. That we reflect God's qualities. And we can't deny it, and we can't neglect it. But we need to be diligent and fan it until that little flame becomes a big, big flame. And by that flame, we light the way for ourselves. We light the way, the race that we're supposed to run, and we become an example to others as well. Let the flame get larger. And in this connection, when I was studying for this, I remembered a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And I'll just share it with you here. It's called The Psalm of Life. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. The talents and abilities that we have are inbuilt within our spiritual selves. They come from God. Just like the light reflected in that chandelier originates in the sun. So the talents that we have originate in God, and they adhere to the soul. And then it said, art is long, time is fleeting, and our hearts, though stout and brave, still like muffled drums are beating funeral marches to the grave. We shouldn't spend so much time figuring out our talent. And once we've acknowledged it and we've recognized it, a lot of people spend years and years and years in graduate school and postgraduate school sharpening and cultivating it. And I know in the past, I've encouraged fine-tuning and sharpening your talents. But there's a line between fine-tuning and sharpening your talents and just wasting time. Imagine if we could have identified our talents when we were in our pre-teens, and if we would have had that association and that mentorship, so that by the time we got to be 18 or 19 years old, we were hitting our stride. Can you imagine that? Whereas most people, they don't even get the opportunity to use their talents until they graduate, get a BA or a master's or a PhD. They're in their late 20s by the time they actually are able to vocationally engage their talents. And talents in vocation is well and good, but actually the talents that we're given are meant not primarily for our vocation, but they're meant to glorify God. So we're putting off glorifying God from a time when we could be doing that at the ages of 12, 13, 14, and 15, to the time we're 27, 28, 29, and it's all vocational based. And it's repressive. And so it said that we don't have, you know, you say, well, I'll go to graduate school and I'll go to postgraduate school. You don't know how long you have left. We're not even guaranteed tomorrow what to speak of 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. If you're a doctor, if you have any medical training and you're in the war, you can't say, I'm going to go and finish my medical school and then I'll come back. Because the urgency is so great. You have to learn by doing. Well, I don't know how to staunch that wound. Well, you better learn right now, because there's no one else to do it. And if you don't do it, he's going to die. So you learn. You learn by doing. So the point is not just to go and educate and educate and educate and educate ad infinitum, but to recognize your talent and use it for the service of the Lord. And in using it, you learn all the things that you need to know. A couple years ago, I wanted to do PowerPoints. I knew nothing about PowerPoints. So Neil tells me there's courses on PowerPoints at Utah Valley University. And I didn't feel I had time or the patience to take courses and then after the courses to apply it. So I just went to Microsoft and I opened it up and I started doing it. And I'll show you the PowerPoints that I did 2 years ago, and they're infantile. They're actually embarrassing. But, you know, and of course, these also leave a lot to be desired. You know, and in fact, to be honest with you, I don't need all the transitions and the twirls and stuff like that. I don't need all that. I don't want it. It just throws off your timing. It's an unnecessary distraction. Just want a basic PowerPoint to illustrate and to engage your visual sense as well as your oral sense as well. Trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead past bury its dead. Act in the living present, heart within, God overhead. And that flame, here is where the flame, lighting the way, lighting your way, and lighting the way for others. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing, leave behind us footprints on the sands of time. Footprints that perhaps another, sailing over life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother, seeing shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing. Learn to labor and to wake. Prabhupada, it was interesting. If someone was in college, if they were like a junior or senior, and they started getting interested in Krishna consciousness, he would tell them, finish college. If you started it, finish it. But if someone was interested in Krishna consciousness, and they were asking, should I go to college or become engaged in Krishna consciousness, he'd say, come into Krishna consciousness. Don't waste 4 years. Don't start something new once you become familiar with Krishna consciousness. And here's an example of a devotee that played guitar. And he asked Prabhupada, should I learn to play sitar? Because he thought some or other that if he learned to play sitar, it would be more in keeping with the culture and the kirtans. And so he asked Prabhupada whether he should take the time out to learn sitar. And you probably read this already. But Prabhupada says, no, basically. He says, you have a special talent, and it's in guitar, not in sitar. So, and you've already invested a lot of time in that. So now is the time, just use that for Krishna. He says, I think you can go on playing guitar, playing on your guitar, and make it successful for Krishna kirtan. You do not require to learn freshly about sitar. We're not meant for learning something new for the service of the Lord, but we have to engage whatever talents we already got. Our life is short, but any type of education is great and long. So the best part of valor, and I think Prabhupada, he went to an English college. I think he's actually mindful of this poem by Longfellow, art is long, you know, art, life, whatever it is. I think he's actually, there's echoing it here in his words here. He says, whatever qualifications we have got for the service of the Lord, if you think still that you want a sitar, and then he says, okay, and then it's kind of funny the way he just makes a concession here. He says, if she runs around, I don't really care, but the noise, if she could just keep quiet, that'd be good. He says, but still, if you think you want a sitar, I will request you to make correspondence with Messrs. Dworkin and Sons, located in the Esplanade in Calcutta. So, the practical sense there after all. You don't need to be so sophisticated to serve the Lord. Here's an elephant, here's a monkey, and a vulture. And they all achieved perfection. Obviously, they weren't sophisticated. They didn't have postgraduate degrees. The elephant, he was Gajendra. He was caught by a crocodile while he was in the water. And he offered the Lord a lotus flower. Not a very sophisticated thing. He was in a lake with lotus flowers. His leg was caught by the crocodile. He was pulling in. And he wanted to appeal to the Lord for help. But he didn't want to be empty-handed. Just like the members of our Krishna conscious culture, they come to the temple and they don't come empty-handed. Because he's the Lord and we're the servants. So the servant comes to the temple with a flower, with a fruit, with a gallon of milk, or a little rice, or something like that. So Gajendra, he wanted to address the Lord, but he didn't want to do it without offering something. So he was in this lake, being dragged by the crocodile under a lot of lotuses. So he just picked up a lotus flower, and he offered to the Lord with prayers. And the Lord accepted his devotion. I don't know how sophisticated the prayers were. Actually, it actually happens. They were quite sophisticated. But that wasn't the point. He accepted his devotion. Shh. 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 And then Hanuman. Hanuman was a little crude. When Lakshman was lying in a coma on the battlefield, Hanuman was told he could go to the Himalayas, get a certain herb and bring it back, and it would bring Lakshman back to life. Sanjivani. Well, Hanuman was a little crude. And when he got there, he forgot exactly the description, what that herb looked like. So he brought the mountain back. He just picked up the mountain and brought it back. Little crude, you see. He didn't have a degree in botany or zoology or any of that stuff. But he wanted to serve Ram so badly that he brought the whole mountain back. And then finally, Jatayu. Jatayu's case is instructive on a number of different levels. First of all, Jatayu was a vulture. And a vulture is not even considered to be normally a pious living being. You know why vultures are bare? Why they're bare? They don't have any feathers. Because they can stick their head into the stomach of a roadkill, and you know, feathers would make it messy. So vultures are not exactly pious like swans or other living beings. And yet, when Sita was kidnapped by Ravana, Jatayu challenged Ravana. He says, "You cannot take Sita. She is in my charge, and you will have to fight me." Jatayu was elderly. Ravana was at the peak of his powers. He was vicious. He had yogic powers. And in the fight, he slashed Jatayu's wings. Jatayu spiraled to earth where he lay dying and defeated. And yet, look at this. Here is Ramachandra personally holding Jatayu in his arms. And Jatayu has the supreme benediction of looking into the eyes of Sri Ramachandra at the time of leaving his body. So he wasn't a sophisticated college graduate. Neither did he achieve victory. He was defeated. He did not succeed in his effort to protect Sita. She was kidnapped anyway, and he was killed. But there was no shame, and there was no loss for Jatayu. Ram appreciated his supreme effort, even in defeat. And that's the beautiful thing about devotional service. It doesn't matter whether you win or whether you lose. It only matters that you tried your best. The result is up to the Lord. Here's a poem by Evelyn Weatherald. "My orders are to fight, and that if I bleed or fall or strongly win, what matters it? God only doth prevail. The servant craveth not except to serve with might. I was not told to win or lose. My orders are to fight." So what talents do we have? What's God's thumbprint on you? Maybe some of you are businessmen. Maybe some of you would like to make money and give it to Krishna. And you have a business sense. And it's good. We have devotees, like we have the grandson of Henry Ford, Ambarish, worth millions and millions of dollars. He gave, I think, $1 million to buy the Hawaii temple. He gave $1 million to buy the Detroit temple. He's giving $10 million to build a new temple in West Bengal in Mayapur. But let's say, although you want to make money, let's say you don't succeed. Let's say your money-making ability or business sense does not bring you but a pittance, you see. Still, the Lord is pleased by your using your talents the way that He gave them, by your running the race that you are meant to run. Example of this is 500 years ago, Kolavachar Sridhar lived in Navadvip at the same time as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Kolavachar Sridhar was a businessman, and his business was selling banana leaves. If you've been in India, everyone eats off of banana leaves. And then they just throw, and the dogs come and lick the grease and all. So how much do you sell banana leaves for? I mean, like, I don't know, 1/100 of a penny? And so he was selling, making hardly anything, and still giving half to support the Sankirtan movement of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Lord Chaitanya used to come every day and engage in katha with Kolavachar Sridhar. He didn't go to the big, big rich men, you know, who gave more, but without feeling. He went to Kolavachar Sridhar, and they had beautiful, sweet dialogue. Sweet, sweet relationships. The Prabhupada says here in his purport to the Srimad Bhagavatam 7.9.9, "Our this movement is based on practical activity. Whatever talent you've got, whatever little strength you've got, education you've got, you haven't got to learn anything. Whatever you've got, in whatever position you are, you can serve Krishna. Karmani avada karashte mafadashu. You have a right to do your duty, but you do not have a right to dictate what the results of that will be." So there are two things that we need to do in order to understand God's thumbprint upon us and find out the race that we're supposed to run. And the first thing is, we need to know what our gifts are. It's okay to be frustrated. It's okay to be frustrated. To feel like you're in a job that's unfulfilling, to feel like you're in the drone zone, to feel that you're running someone else's race. It's okay to be frustrated and to be wrestling with this, you know. But it's not okay to be frustrated and complain and not do anything about it. It's not okay not to do something about it. All you ladies, you've had the experience of us men when we've been sick. Radhakrishna was sick recently, and he would sit there at the table, and he would just look miserable, and he was hacking and coughing and phlegm and all like that, and day after day after day. And I went and I sat with him one time, and he was telling me all this. I said, "Radha, why don't you go to the doctor?" So, you know, and his wife probably said, "Why didn't you go to the doctor? You know, why didn't you go to the doctor?" You know, well, I don't know if she did it or not, but she had every right, you know, after this goes on for a few days, to go up and say, put her hands on her shoulder, look him in the eye and say, "Look, darling, you're the light of my life. You know, the sun rises and sets you. But I'm telling you this, if you don't go to the doctor, you don't have the right to complain around here anymore. Yeah. You don't have the right to complain anymore. You have to do something about it." So we need to figure out what it is that we need to do and what it is that we're invested and talented with. And we need to use it in God's service. Identifying a talent is one thing, but it's another thing to identify and know what you're good at, what God has given, and then use it for your own glory. That is called asuric mentality. The devas, the divine beings, use that which is given to them back in the service of he from whom it comes. If you're LDS, this is consecration, giving back to from where it comes. But the asuras, the demoniac mentality, they may recognize their talents, but then they use it for their own self-aggrandizement. This is a picture of the demons and the devotees. On the left-hand side are the devotees, and on the right-hand side are the demons. And they churned the ocean of milk, and they got, among other things, they got milk and they got wine. Those are two of the byproducts. So the demons, they were offered milk. You guys want the milk? You can take the milk. Drinking milk, you get finer tissues within the brain. Milk is called liquid gold. Any society where cows are happy and they're not slaughtered and they're treated with care and respect is a happy society. Where the cows are happy, the human beings are happy. The demons, they had no interest. Yuck, I don't want everybody happy. I want me to be happy and me to live happily at their expense. I want my happiness to be on the heads of their misery. So they didn't have any interest. Let the devas take the milk, the Sarabi cow. Let the devas take the Sarabi cow. But when they got a chance to get the Varuni beverage, the fermented honey and the alcohol, they said, "Yeah, we'll take that." That really... What happened to the sound all of a sudden? Does that mean what that portends? Could you take a look at that? See why everything went up about 6 decibels. So we need to learn how to use everything for Vishnu. And in the Bhagavad Gita, it says, Yagnartat kamano nyatara loko yam karma bandhana. It says, this is called yagya. The LDS idea of consecration is called as yagya. And if you're from India, you think of yagya as a fire sacrifice where you offer the samagri and you please the Lord and you say, "Swaha, let it be consumed." But yagya means any talent, any ability you have, offered to the Lord. The jumping ability of Hanuman, he offered it to the Lord. The flying ability of Jatayu, he offered it to the Lord. The ability to pluck a lotus flower with his trunk, the elephant, offered it to the Lord. This is all yagya, offering it back to the Lord. Yagya is not just offering things for the Lord to eat. He has many senses. Ananyasya sakalendriya. When we offer our food to the Lord, he eats the prayers and the devotion and the intelligence with which we offer the food. That's his characteristic. He has transcendental senses such that any one sense can fulfill the full-fledged functions of any other. We can only eat with our mouth, we can only smell with our nose, we can only see with our eyes. But when the Lord hears the prayers, when we offer food to him, when he hears the prayers, he eats. His senses being interchangeable, he eats. He enjoys the taste of the food by hearing the prayers that we say in terms of offering them to him. And in the purport to this verse, that sacrifice for Vishnu has to be performed. Otherwise, work binds one to this material world. Prabhupada says, one can avoid worshiping an ordinary man, or serving an ordinary man, or even an extraordinary man. But one cannot avoid recognizing where one's talents and gifts come from and giving them back to him. One cannot avoid that without being thoroughly condemned. Thoroughly condemned. So this appears not to be optional. It appears to be mandated by the Lord. Use it or lose it. You've got talents and abilities, use them for the Lord or lose them. There's a brother and sister combination again amongst the demoniac races. On the top is Hiranyakashipu, being uncomfortably stretched on the Sringadev's lap. He had such talents, such abilities, and he used them only for tyranny and only to repress people. And in the end, the Lord came as the half-man, half-lion incarnation and bifurcated him as easily as a wasp, as a child bifurcates a wasp with some straw. And underneath Holika was Hiranyakashipu's sister. She also had a benediction that she couldn't be burned by fire. What a wonderful talent that would be. If you couldn't be burned fire, you join the fire department, you join search and rescue, right? You go into blazing buildings, warehouses, and you bring, this would be like a monthly occurrence, you know, and he's done it again, you know, it's a 10th time this month, you know, or he went into that building 10 times, you know, and brought 10 people out, you know, man of the year, you know, the president's award, humanitarian, Nobel Prize. Nah, Holly wasn't interested in that. She just burned babies. She just burned babies, you know. She could have done this, but instead the most abominable, horrible, ghastly thing at the exact opposite end of the spectrum, she burned babies. And both of them were utterly destroyed. Prabhupada says here, they are sure to become failures because our knowledge, our intelligence, our talent, strength, opulence, everything depends on God, Krishna. He gives you a little knowledge and so you become puffed up. He gives you a little intelligence and then you become proud. But as soon as he likes, he can withdraw immediately and you lose everything. Hiranyakashipu thought he was so powerful that he was God. And he said, don't worship God. Don't worship God. Worship me. I am God. I am better than God. And yet God decided to withdraw his talents and he became nothing inside of a moment. Samsidhya Hari Tosanam. Samsidhi. Siddhi means perfection. Sam means to satisfy, and Toshanam also means satisfy, and Hari is a name for God. The perfection of life is to satisfy the Lord with the talents and abilities that we have. Everyone has got some special talent given by God. We should cooperate. The hand can work in this way. We cannot walk with hands. That's the business of the hand, of the foot, I think it meant to say. I cannot cut papers with your leg. So all living entities are specially endowed. We should cooperate. The hand and leg should cooperate for maintaining the whole body. Similarly, everybody should use his talent for the satisfaction of Krishna. That is perfection. Don't compete with one another. That is a mistake. So where I'm strong, you're weak. Where I'm weak, you're strong. We're meant to work together. We cannot walk on our hands. The legs are for that. You see what I'm saying? We cannot write with our legs. Our hands are for that. Everybody has unique talents, and we're meant to use those talents together, cooperatively, to make a wholesome and harmonious society. The head thinks, the arms defend, the belly digests and gives strength, and the legs walk. You have the four parts of the body, and similarly in the social body, everybody is created in just such a way as to cooperate with everybody else. And so we're better together. We're better in community. We're meant to live in community and complement each other. And we shouldn't wait for perfect conditions to use our talents. Krishna says, better you meet with destruction in the course of fulfilling your own race, running your own race, than to do another duty perfectly. So don't wait for perfection. Don't expect to please Krishna perfectly either, because he's infinite and we're infinitesimal. So we can never really do anything that is perfectly done, that is perfectly satisfactory, because we are imperfect and limited. But Krishna sees the devotion, he sees the sincerity, and he sees the effort that's put into it. And for him, that is the definition of perfection. Try your best. Krishna sees how sincere we are. Arjuna, you know, he had two options. Neither one of them was good. Neither one of them was good. He had faced his relatives, his teachers, his cousins on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. They were tyrants and despots. They had to be killed. And yet, in his culture, you couldn't even hit your teacher with a flower. So much respect you had for your teacher, like Bhisma and Dronacharya. He was totally conditioned to respect his gurus and not to shoot arrows at them, but to offer flowers. It went against everything that Arjuna had been trained to do to try to kill Bhisma and Dronacharya. It was the anathema. It was a horrible thing. And he thought, even if they're bad guys and I kill them, I will never enjoy life after that. I will never enjoy life with the stigma of having killed my teachers and my cousins. So that he didn't see how any happiness could come from that. And if he walked away from the battlefield because of scruples based on bodily attachment, then they would have had the door wide open to do all kinds of sins and to harass the innocent citizenry. And Arjuna would have been guilty by omission for that. So really, there was no good outcome. There's no Hollywood ending here. But because he did what he was trained to do, he used his fighting talents according to the instruction of Krishna, he achieved perfection. He achieved perfection. It wasn't a perfect result, but he was perfect because he acted. He took the option that Krishna offered him. And you've read it already, but we have this out on audio, so I'm just going to read it too. Any work that you do, do it very nicely. To your best talent, to your best capacity. Try to finish it very nicely. You are entrusted with some work. If you think that you're unable to do that work, then do whatever work you can do, you take. But do not imitate, oh, he's doing that, and I shall copy him. Don't do that. You take up what you can do and do it nicely. We have to do so many works. Krishna is not that he is static. He is dynamic force. Arjuna was not a Vedantist, not a Brahmin, not a sannyasi. He was a householder, a military man, but he knew his business. So you do your business perfectly. That is perfection. So recognize what our talents are. Use them in the service of the Lord and not for personal gain. And then leverage opportunities to use your talents. Leverage opportunities to use your talents. I was listening to a talk by a young preacher in Atlanta, Georgia, who was actually employed in the business world. He'd been brought up, Jeff Henderson's his name, he'd been brought up in a preacher's family, and he and his father, when they were teenagers, they'd gone out and done preaching in, you know, different venues and traveled and all like that. And then he got into the corporate world and he was working in a corporate set. And one day his father called him up and he said, Jeff, he said, I've got two invitations on the same Sunday at the same time in different cities. And I can't be in both places at the same time. So would you take a Sunday and go off to this town in Georgia and would you give the sermon for me? And he said, sure, Dad, I'll do that. And he went and he gave the sermon. And after the sermon, the crowd was politely... And he says he never trusts, you know, when people say that was a good sermon. Because if you look around, it's usually the people that slept through the sermon that tell you it was a good sermon, you know. So people were filing out and saying it was a good sermon, good sermon, good sermon. And one lady says, young man, you should be ashamed of yourself. Because he'd mentioned he's in the corporate world and he just came to do that sermon like he does maybe two sermons a year or something. Then she says, you should be ashamed of yourself. And he was saying, well, maybe she actually stayed awake during the sermon and heard what she said, what I said, and realized it wasn't very good. But no, that wasn't her intention at all. She said, you should be ashamed of yourself. Because when God asks you whether you use your talents, you're not going to be able to give a satisfactory answer. She says, you're wasting your talent. In other words, she's saying, you're such a good communicator. You've been gifted with a flame that you, with that flame, you can light the way to others, and you're wasting your talent making money in the business world. She said, young man, you should be ashamed of yourself. And that actually led him, that comment led him to get out of the corporate world and become a full-time communicator on behalf of the Lord. In our Srimad Bhagavatam, there's an example of an artist using her talents in the service of the Lord. Chitraleka had dreamed of this beautiful boy and knew that he was to be her future husband, but she didn't know who he was or where he existed in the world. She had a maidservant named Chitraleka who was like these police identity artists. And so she had described the nose and the ears and the beauty and the bodily hue and the hair and all like this. And Chitraleka went to work and she started drawing pictures. So she came up with Charusena, who was in the Yadu dynasty, Anukundundubi. He came up, drew a picture of Balaram. Krishna, is this the one you're dreaming about? Is this the one you're dreaming about? And then she drew a picture of Pradyumna, who was Aniruddha's brother. And she blushed It was so close, but it wasn't actually him. And then she drew a picture of Aniruddha. And Usha put her head down in embarrassment and smiled. And she said, he's the one. So Prabhupada says here, by using our talents, we can overflood the world. Krishna's not meant just to be cooped up for 1 hour and we visit him in the temple 1 hour a week. He's meant to be everywhere because he is all pervasive. And everywhere there are living entities, there is talent, there's abilities, and those are meant to be used universally in order to glorify the Lord and light the way to others, whether it be art or music, everything we can utilize. Anything that one is addicted to, any singing, eating, painting, cooking, dancing, everything's there in Krishna consciousness. Business, making money, engineering, construction temple. Look at Vaibhavi. Beautiful, beautiful temple that she's done as useful of her talent. Prabhupada says it's an all-perfect movement. Krishna means all attractive. So everything can be, everyone can be attracted and give up everything for Krishna, and we can act in such a way that will give up all lesser things in order for the greater thing. Whether you be interested in architecture, use it for Krishna. If you're interested in dance, dance for Krishna. Deities involve making of flower gardens, cleanliness, sewing, music, as well as yoga. Do it for Krishna. Cuisine, cook for Krishna, make offerings to Krishna. Parades, Jayananda here, leading the Rath Yatra in 1978 in San Francisco. You like to write, here's our Back to Godhead magazine. So many literatures. International Society for Krishna Consciousness produced so many literatures. Constantly, books are being published all the time. You like to organize festivals. Organize festivals for Krishna. You like to garden. Go ahead and garden for Krishna. You like to protect the cows. Protect Krishna's cows from slaughter and abuse. We also have llama protection here. And the llamas do good service, you know. They rent themselves out. Boy Scouts going to Wind River, Yellowstone, and they earn money for the temple. You like drama? Then do dramas for Krishna. If you're like Ambarish, Henry Ford's grandson, make money and support the temples. If you like public speaking, then speak and glorify Krishna. The point is, it's not about us. It's not about us. It's to use our talents to let them shine, to fan the flames, so that everyone may see God in ourselves. If you don't know your gifts and leverage, I think not only do you lose by not recognizing your gifts and using them, but everybody else loses as well. It's not only your loss, but it's everybody else's loss, because Krishna made you to be a light to other people, and Krishna wants you to serve your fellow mankind by using your talents. It's about you understanding what God wants to do through you, and so try to pray and to begin to run your own race, so that at the finish line, you'll hear this sound, well done, my good and faithful servant. When we get this right, then not only you win, but everybody wins. So we'll conclude with this prayer for you. May you not neglect the thumbprints which are on you. May you be diligent. May you give yourself wholly to this. May you find the gifts that are upon you, and may you find the unique race which is set out just for you. May you run with hope and vision and the truth that someday you hear these words, well done, well done, well done. And if you like, with me, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.